say a little bit about his life, and then after that we'll hear some of his music. I'll make some general remarks first, and then after that I'll go more specifically into each of the three main musical periods of his life, and then we'll hear a representative piece from each of the three periods. First, generally, Bach in his times, during his lifetime, saw himself and was seen by others as a successful musician, but by no means was he regarded as spectacular or great. He was merely a hardworking and reasonably successful musician. And he regarded himself as a conscientious craftsman who was working to the best of his ability for those who hired him, the court, for example, or the church. He worked as hard as he could for his listeners, and he worked to the glory of God. But again, it's important to remember that he was not seen as a great giant in the musical world. There were at least half a dozen musicians in Germany who were much more popular and well-known than Bach was during his lifetime. And although reasonably successful and well-off, he knew much tragedy in his life, too. For example, he was orphaned at age 10. His first wife died after just a few years of marriage. The last 10 years of his life, he had a severe eye illness, and he was blind for the last 5 or 6 years of his life. And he underwent several operations for this blindness, and operations in those days were ordeals, and he died as a result of the operations after a stroke. And even after his death, this tragedy went on. His second wife, Anna Magdalena, died in poverty 10 years after Bach died. More specifically now, the first 10 years of his life, he was taught music by his father in the home. And then in 1695, his parents died, and he went to the home of his older brother, Johann Christoph. And Johann taught him music until he was age 15, and he went to Lüneburg, which is a small town 70 kilometers south of Hamburg. And there, he was a student in a church gymnasium, or church high school, preparatory school, you could call it, and also an apprentice musician there. And was able to spend several months there in Lüneburg once, and the church where he worked and the organ that he practiced on are still there, and it's fascinating to go and hear concerts and church music played on the organ and think when he was a boy, he sat there and played it. It made him so much more alive to me to be able to hear music on the organ where he played. After his apprenticeship, he entered the first main musical stage of his life. Could be characterized with the words the young organist. In 1708, at age 18, he took an appointment as a church organist at Arnstadt, which is a small town in northern Germany. And something of his personality can be seen from one incident at this town. They said that he was a hard-working, conscientious musician, and could see as a perfectionist. And there was one musician in the church, a bassoon player, who was little luck, happy-go-lucky when it came to music. He did good enough, but he didn't work too hard. One day Bach saw him in the marketplace, and he was so fed up with this attitude that he just beat the man, had to pull off him, simply because he didn't like the way he played bassoon. During this period, he produced his first cantatas, and later on we'll hear a cantata as representative of this period. Also during these 3 years, in 1707, he married his second cousin, Maria Barbara Bach, and together they had 7 children. In 1708, he entered the second main musical period of his life, could be called the master organist period. And he was a court organist and a concert master of the court orchestra and a musician for the Royal Church in Weimar. And during this period, 1708 to 1717, he produced most of his major organ works. After this, he entered the third period, which is could be called the court musician. And he worked in service to Prince Leopold, who was at Köthen, Germany. And Leopold himself was a very knowledgeable and himself artistic patron of the arts. And he hired Bach to produce music for the court, and he produced most of his so-called secular music then. We'll hear the Brandenburg Concerto No. 4 from this. And he stayed here for several years. And then in 1723, after 2 years there, he was offered a position at the Church and School of St. Thomas in Leipzig. And this was the highest position in Lutheran church music in Germany. And it was quite an honor for Bach to receive this, although he was selected for this only after several other more prominent musicians had been passed over. They didn't want it for some reason or another, and he ended up with it. And from 1723 until his death in 1750, this was his main work in this church and school. And he had several other minor jobs or minor honorary jobs, but most of his energy was concentrated here. Also during this period, his first wife died, and he married another woman, Magdalena Kilkin, and together they had 13 children. So to get up with his two wives, he had 20 kids. He didn't just produce a lot of music. In 1740, after about 15 years in this position, his eye disease began, and by 1749 he was completely blind. And in 1750, as I said, after several torturous operations, he died. That's about all I'll say. I'd rather go to the music than talk too much. The three periods, again, are the young organist. We'll hear a cantata from that. The second, the master organist. Hear Passacaglia Fugue in C minor, part of it. And then last of all, we'll hear Brandenburg Concerto No. 4 from his court musician period. And before each piece, Jeff will say something about the piece. So first of all, it's cantata number 140.
Was there a lot of organ music already composed that he played, or did he compose most of the music that he played?
Both. A lot of his work was based on writing introductions and variations to other pieces. And he was criticized a lot for this during his life. Some people thought maybe he shouldn't be doing so much to other people's music, but as a result of being so familiar with all the other music, he was able to learn from that music and put a lot of the good things in those other pieces into his own.
Now, there was much sharing and borrowing from others, and also in his own works, in his own volumes of works. He would borrow a movement here, put it in something else, transcribe a movement from a choral piece to an organ piece, as in the case of the Schubler Chorale, which we will hear in this cantata we're about to hear at 140. This is one way in which Bach became aware of the styles of the other countries, because unlike Handel, Bach did not travel widely, except for the one famous trip to hear Buxtehude play, a trip which in his early years, I think, cost him his job, or at least a great reprimand. He traveled on foot a great distance to Dresden, I think, and I'm not sure the names of the towns, but in any case, he stayed for a long time to hear this man and to hear this man's music and study with this man, Buxtehude. He had a great influence on him. He also transcribed in the organ works of Bach. There are out-and-out transcriptions of Vivaldi concertos with Bach's name on them, and also Johann Ernst, a court musician. Another is a transcription of his work into Bach organ. In fact, I have those along. Yeah.
Can you explain to me how come we have such a reservoir of Bach music, where I think there were probably other composers who wrote also so much? When was he recognized as somebody whose works we needed to save, or how was it that it works out that way?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because, in fact, he was not that well known in his own time. It wasn't until
1800.
About 100 years later that. Particularly Mendelssohn had a great deal to do with reviving Bach. This is an interesting point. In Mendelssohn's organ works, you really see the Bach influence coming through, but Mendelssohn and some of these romantics rediscovered Bach. And a lot of Bach's music whereas we have a lot of his music extant, a lot of it was lost, particularly in the cantatas. But why, I suppose in many attics and a lot of his books were written for pedagogical purposes, for the church and for students learning to play. For example, his second wife, Anna Magdalena Bach, he wrote a little volume of music for her to learn how to play, to improve her technique. He wrote the trio sonatas of the organ for one of his sons to improve his technique. He wrote the liturgical year, which he didn't complete, a series of chorale preludes on chorales throughout the church year for use in the church. So these were all very useful things, and that's probably why a lot of them remained. Before we hear the cantata, I should say, Bach set out tasks for himself that were always phenomenal, and he approached them in a very methodical way. For example, in the cantatas, he set out to set a cantata for every Sunday of the church year, and but on a wider, I don't know what he was using for pericopes right offhand, but it's the cycle, as he set out, I think would have included close to 500 cantatas. And then, if I'm not mistaken, now someone can correct me if I'm wrong, it seems to me that he wrote almost 500 cantatas, although 200, only 200 have survived, and many were lost. Now, the cantatas for the year were based on the text, the ideas, bringing in the chorale that would fit that Sunday. The one we are about to hear is cantata 140, Wacket auf, ruft uns die Stimme, wake, wake, my, the wake, awake,
the night is
flying, an Advent cantata. And in this, in the opening chorus, we'll hear the soprano line being the chorale tune. Following this, in this particular cantata, is a duet. There's sort of recitative and duet. And then there's another chorus, which again brings in the chorale tune. And it's this second chorus, which has been transcribed to be an organ work. Then there's more solo and duet work. And then there's a concluding chorus. Most of Bach's cantatas, of course, they're all sacred texts. They would have an opening chorus, and then maybe four movements of recitative and aria, and then a concluding chorus. So that was the usual form, usually about a seven, eight movement work. This one is a little grander scale with a chorus in the middle of men singing this.
Just hear that, the beginning of that.
Oh, okay. That's all we're going to hear is just that. Oh, okay.
Let's hear it.
Separate setting of the chorale. Bach would take a phrase of the chorale, and would, from that phrase, in the long note values in the soprano, he would derive motivic material of similar intervallic relationships and weave it in underneath this long chorale that's going in the soprano voice. In addition, he also, you heard the oboe dancing about in an obbligato sort of fashion. In other words, when the choir was singing, most of the strings were doubling the choir, the choral line, except the oboe is doing its own thing. And that makes it sort of special. In a simpler cantata, there would simply be doublings all the way through when the choir was singing. This is in contrast now to the next movement we'll hear, which is a trio. It's just a three-voice piece. There'll be a bass line and an obbligato treble. I don't know, remember if it's an oboe or a violin. And then the men and another instrument singing the chorale. It's a much simpler setting, but a very interesting one. But three voices. That is three-voice texture. It'll be more than one person singing, but there's a particularly fine recording by Herbert von Karajan. I think one of the better recordings of it, a German group, of course. Anyway, those are really excellent music, and fun to listen to. I hate to stop it. I wanted to get in a little bit about Handel and Schütz before we all leave. The time is close. We got 5 minutes. So let me just briefly say some things about Handel. And first of all, Handel and Bach were born the same year. I don't know how many people were aware of that, but they were contemporaries, although they did not, I don't think, ever met. They knew of each other. But Handel was a much more prominent figure than Bach. Handel was well known in his time. He was a court musician more than a church musician. Was an impresario in his own right, running his own, for a while, his own opera house and company, and openly competing for the market of people to come and hear these operas that he would write. Handel's output was also more, there was more opera, more oratorio, which an oratorio is, in Handel's time, was the same thing as an opera, except it had sacred text, biblically based. Handel was very popular because he did this very thing. He used the Bible, which to the masses was the common book. He used the vernacular. They could understand it. Even though he was using Italian style, he was using, which maybe wasn't native to England, he was at least using the vernacular, and he was using the Bible in these oratorios, which had great, great appeal and made him very popular with the people of England. And then, in addition, he was popular because he was writing these operas, and the people that liked that liked him too. He gained favor in the courts. He was a court musician. He composed volumes of instrumental music, chamber music, besides these operas and oratorios. The oratorio, however, should not be thought of as church music. The oratorio was meant to be performed in a stage setting, and is not something, it was never intended to be church music, per se. Yeah,
You're talking about England?
Yes.
He was in England?
Yeah.
He was German, though.
Okay, you're right. Handel was a real cosmopolitan figure, which also it enters into play for his popularity and for his fame at his time. He was a German. He was born in Saxony. He studied in Italy, and he moved to England. And there he stayed, and his fame spread. There's England really claims him. Yes, Walt.
He started work for the court of Hanover.
Right.
And the Hanovers became the Windsors. They changed their name when they became the kings of the royal house in England, and that's how Handel made his move from Europe, from the continent, to England, because he was working for the House of Hanover in Germany, and they were related to the royal house in England.
Right, but did he not have, hadn't he left, though, on furlough and was due back, and during that time while he was, and he had gone to England, left Hanover, but then this transition took place and all these people came over to England.
Yes.
And he was in sort of a funny position because he had been tardy to return.
Yes.
And he had to regain favor with the House of Windsor, formerly the House of Hanover, and for this he wrote the water music.
Yes.
To get back in good graces.
Yes. He's buried in Westminster Abbey, you know, pretty prominent place, so that shows that you have, you know.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Here again, using the Baroque principles, besides being a cosmopolitan figure and having and pulling in many of the praxes from these different countries, he too was a master of contrast in his styles and musical style. I was going to play a couple of things, but I don't want to because I want to say something about Schütz too, and we're up against the time here.
No, I think we have a little bit of time, Jeff. We can go to maybe 20 or 12 or
40. Okay. All right.
Do you have a excerpt?
These happen to be what were handy, which is from Messiah.
Okay.
I have a question.
Yes.
I was listening to some, I don't know if it was 17th century music or what, and I thought I recognized part of the Messiah in it. And so I asked the person, you know, am I listening to the Messiah or what? And he said, well, Handel had kind of lived it.
Yeah.
And a lot of his works, or I don't know, a lot of the Messiah at any rate, was lifted from music that was popular at the time.
Well, that's probably true. Messiah, for one thing, here again is a piece written to gain favor, and it was done hastily. Messiah was written in 2 weeks, so you know that he didn't. He had to do some borrowing.
Well, he borrowed from himself.
Right. Certainly, he borrowed a lot of things from within his own works, and possibly from other sources too. I wanted just to let's see, which example do I have here?
The fourth chorus, or the I think the fourth piece of the Messiah, the glory of the Lord, that appears instrumentally and in several other places. Maybe, is that the thing you're referring to?
No, the one I had heard was, what was it, Psalm 25, lift up your heads, O ye gates.
Oh, that's another one that, yeah, appears.
Okay. This is a little bit of a little example of word painting that I thought it's sort of fun, and maybe you've sung this piece and never thought about it, certainly you've heard it. It's not a subtle example. It's all we like sheep have gone astray. And if you listen to it and are aware that first of all he starts out all we like sheep, and then the line starts to meander. You know, have gone astray, just goes astray. And then when he says, we have turned to, or everyone has turned to his own way, the line is goes into 16th note motion and is very, very turning in its character. So listen for that. Let's see if I've got in the right place here. What happens here?
Thank you.
hand laid on him. Introspective, I think, in Bach and Handel. The Lord hath laid on him the iniquity of us all of us scattered people. I don't know if I'll get there. Now we're going to stop it right there. One other little example, and then we're going to sing some Schütz and go. This is, "For unto us a child is born." Here, he uses, "For unto us a ta-da-dee-da." It's, the thing is, the music here is almost a dance. And there's a name for it which escapes me right now, but it's a very dance-like figure, as you'll hear. But then Handel throws in some very punctual things. "Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God." First, we have all these lines, sort of, everyone does their little part and dances their part. And then everyone comes together and says, "Wonderful Counselor," in big strokes of quarter notes and together, suddenly four parts. "Wonderful Counselor." You're familiar with the movement, I'm sure. But just listen to this, how in the middle of this dance, suddenly he proclaims what Christ is here. You're right. Look at it again. Only one or two voice textures here. The basses, the altos. Didn't know these were coming, I think you'd be unprepared for these big strokes that are coming up. Now the texture starts to thicken, they're all together, and here we go. And then back to the dance. I'm going to stop because I want to say something about Schütz, and you know the piece. That's unfortunately. No, let's see, is it? No. It doesn't say on here. You'll have to ask Sharon, I'm not sure. We're going to close. Let me say two or three brief things about Schütz. Schütz was earlier than Handel and Bach. He was also German, but he was subject to the Venetian school, very influenced by Giovanni Gabrieli. I haven't any recorded music here. I just happen to have some psalm settings, and we're going to sing one as a conclusion to this session. His dates were 1585 to 1672, almost a generation before, the generation immediately preceding Bach and Handel.
His music is all church music. He's done some very grand things in the larger works, and even in some of the psalms, although not in this particular volume, we get the contrasting choir style of Gabrieli coming through the old idea of a choir in each balcony and singing back and forth to each other. It's very evident in some in the larger works of Schütz. He's a composer which deserves lots of attention, and I'm sorry I'm giving him just a minute here at the end. These are psalms. The choir sang them the other night. There's two sets of them. They're from the Becker Psalter. Concordia has published them. And we'll just sing one with the harpsichord and be on our way. Pass them around among yourselves. If you're not familiar with them, you should be. You might want to take them back to your... Pass them back that way. To your choir at home. One boy hungry. You can look over shoulders. Look at the setting of Psalm 150, which is in the last one in the book, 16.
Was that the beloved shepherd one?
The that was back to you, yeah. We played it for you once, Drew.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well.